Whoop whoop, because why not? And a whoop whoop because the Lakers finally, DeMarco, finally looked like themselves last night against the Denver Nuggets. And never have I been so apprehensive about a team that was 51-18, but I really needed to see that ball go through the hoop last night. I'm really glad it ended the way that it did.
Now I know how billionaires think, what you just said there. Finally. the number one seed, Travis.
Yes. I know. You're not wrong. That makes me feel a little better, but they sure as you know what, we're right. Not playing like the number one seed. True. They look like anything but the number one seed. And I know that LeBron is a really good response to any questions that anybody, hey, but what about LeBron? Yeah, but what if this, hey, no, LeBron. Hey, yeah, but what if this guy, no, stop it, LeBron. It's a good answer to everything. But when you just don't see the ball go through the hoop for the better part of a couple weeks, it was nice to see the Lakers knock down some shots and look like themselves.
No doubt. Getting the W is all that matters, and it's going to help. But this is funny. This is why I never like when teams are chasing records towards the end of a year, like some sort of you're chasing the Bulls or you're chasing an undefeated season or what have you, because you get away from working on what you should be working on moving into the postseason. So when you're a team like the Lakers and you're playing with house money and you're Frank Vogel and you have LeBron James, who's basically a coach on the floor, you have a chance to work on some strengths and weaknesses or some things that are going to help you. And you may sacrifice a few games here or there. Now, we're going to get up in arms. We're not used to seeing them lose. We don't like to see them lose. But if you lose a game and whatever you worked on in the middle of that loss is going to help you beat, say, a Portland or whoever's coming up in the postseason, then, you know, I'm all for it. So you have to kind of look through it and see what they're trying to build for 2 weeks from now versus whatever opponent you're going to draw, and then try to say, okay, this is going to help make us better. But definitely, no doubt, W's make everything better. It's the greatest deodorant ever invented.
I want to come back to the Lakers specifically here in just 1 second and Kuz's shot, but you mentioned who they're going to play in the first round. Are we sure we want it to be Phoenix and not Portland? Because Phoenix hasn't lost a game in the bubble. They won again last night. Devin Booker's going crazy. I know that the Suns do not have any sort of playoff pedigree at all and that Portland does, but just in the hotness factor, is Portland actually a better draw than Phoenix at this point? And I don't think they are, but Phoenix just keeps winning games, DeMarco.
You know, this is funny, and you have a feeling, and there's nothing I can pull up stat-wise that could prove my point. It's just a gut feeling. I would want to avoid Devin Booker as much as possible. Mm. I do. I just there's something about him that I don't like when he's, you know, coming the other direction. He's just that sort of guy that refuses to die. And will give you all sorts of problems. Even if you beat him in a series, he will tax you trying to do it. You know what I mean? So yeah. If I can avoid guys like him, then so be it. I don't think they'll be able to beat the Lakers in the postseason, but just guys like him will make it so hard on you that even if you get by him, you'll be taxed for the next round, and then it could be all over. So I want to avoid him more than anyone else in the postseason.
Yeah, what felt like a pretty easy first-round matchup in Memphis prior to the pandemic now feels like something that no matter who you get, unless it's Memphis, and that's seeming less likely every day, it's going to be a challenge. Because you either get Devin Booker, who's cooking, or you get Damian Lillard, who is Damian Lillard. That's just it's just his own guy right now. But back to last night, here's Kyle Kuzma talking about knocking down that game shot, and he's taking that shot no matter who's guarding it.
I think Jesus could be in front of me, and I'll probably still shoot. So, I mean, it don't really matter to me. Just got an open look. It's a play that we kind of ran and practiced a few times prior to the restart. And, you know, coach had faith in me and just called my number, and I, paid off.
That is a confident dude. He is, since he's come into this league, he has not lacked confidence. He's lacked winning. That's something that has not happened. But this is Kyle Kuzma has never one day in his NBA career thought that he's not that dude.
There is a fine line between confident and crazy. And that statement is flirting with it. Just on a side note, if you're the PR department, if you're LeBron James, a leader on the team, if you're Frank Vogel, will you pull him aside and say, maybe that's not the best way to answer that question?
I wouldn't. I think that because I don't get the sense that Kyle Kuzma's playing at this. You know what I mean? I think this is just who he is. There are some guys when they start chirping, it feels like, okay, take it easy there, Turbo. That's not who you are. That's yeah. not your deal. You're not a talker. You're just trying to do this for reasons, whether it's to try to pump yourself up or to try to brand yourself or whatever. Just take it easy. Kyle Kuzma has been talking like this since he showed up in the league before we even knew how to say his last name right. You know what I mean? This is yes. just who this dude is. So no, I'd let him be him, man. I okay. wouldn't try to change a thing.
This is the type of stuff, this is just my opinion, that comes back to haunt you in a normal world. If you had to go on the road, I mean, how many people do you think would show up looking like Jesus that night? And if you missed the shot, you know what I'm saying? You know, I mean, that's something you might not want to say. I'd never heard Jordan or any of the best shooters in the world ever say anything like that. I appreciate it. It's great stuff. I love the confidence, but maybe you might want to word that a little bit differently.
Jordan wouldn't say it yeah. publicly, but Jordan was the ultimate blank talker on the court. Like him and Larry Bird were guys that were just ruthless when it came to running their mouth to their contemporaries. They didn't say it as much publicly, but yeah. they would absolutely do it.
And I heard Jordan say he is God, so it's a little bit different. Yeah,
exactly. right. Well, the great line about Larry Bird and the three-point contest when one year where he walks into the locker room and says, which one of you blanker blankers is finishing second?
Wow. I mean, all the confidence would have just drained right out of me.
yeah. yeah. It's like, oh, okay.
I thought I had a shot.
yeah. Yeah. I guess I can get second. Right. That's who those guys are for sure.
Absolutely.
Do you put him into the starting lineup? Because Kyle Kuzma, the numbers will tell you, he is a better player when he's in the starting lineup. But here's Frank Vogel saying that it does not seem that that's going to be the way that it is. It's a matchup issue.
I think it's unlikely that we keep him in a starting lineup. It's something I want to look at. You know, something we have available with, depending on what matchup we're looking at. You know, we're likely going to need two quick guards the way most of these teams that we could be facing. It's a small ball league, you know, so we're going to need speed, defensive speed on the perimeter. So, you know, KCP and Danny is likely the starting lineup. But, you know, again, you get in different matchups, you know, their three man is 6'10" and Michael Porter Jr. So, I mean, if you get into a matchup against Denver or against another team that is big like this, that could be an option for us. So it's just another part of the trial and error and evaluation of looking at different things during these seeding games.
DeMarco, take me through it. Take me through the mindset of being a starter versus a bench player, because Kyle Kuzma is much better when he starts than when he comes off of the bench. Why?
You know, I could tell you it's way different, you know, being a starter, being a frontline guy, being a focal point of the opponent. They've worked on what you do and you're working on what they do. And it's a styles clash. I mean, when you get in there, I mean, it's really like a Braveheart battle. One side runs in, the other side runs in, and you meet in the middle, and it's just like a brouhaha. But when you come off the bench, it's a little bit different because you had a chance to, you know, watch everything unfold. The emotions kind of dissipate or things change a little bit. You get a chance to come in and find your spot as a backup. So you have to be prepared for that. I mean, you get all jacked up like everybody else when you do the breakdown, you know, 1, 2, 3 Lakers, and you take the court. You're as jacked up as LeBron, but you have to kind of temper that because you're on the bench for a little bit. So you have to be ready when your name is called, but it's a little bit easier to be a starter. It's to be a starter because, like I said, the game plan is around you, but it's the same for a guy that's coming off the bench. You're not sure when Frank Vogel is going to insert you into the game, but you have to be as locked in as the starter, and then when you come in, your game has to be on point. You don't have a few shots to get yourself up to speed. You got to be ready right now, so it's easier to be a guy coming off the bench, and it's also equally as tough because you got to come right in and be like you have to behave and play like a guy who started the game. So it's tougher. So for Kyle Kuzma, it's the same thing, man. And for Frank Vogel, this will be the question: when do you insert him in the game? When do you go big? When do you put Kuzma in there if you're not going to start him? When things are out of hand or when things are going the way you want them? When do you put him in and when do you get the advantage with him? That's going to be the next step for the Lakers, in my opinion.
We'll ask Michael Thompson that. He's going to join us at 9:15 because Michael has always been of the opinion it doesn't matter who the five guys are at the beginning. It matters who the five guys are at the end. And more often than not, we've seen Kuz in the game at the end. And, you know, I think about the Lakers when Michael was there. The guy that was never a starter but almost always on the court at the end of the game was Michael Cooper. right? Mm-hmm. Michael Cooper was an integral part of what the Lakers did. Michael Cooper would start very, very rarely, and only on occasions where maybe a guy like Byron Scott or somebody was hurt and he had to fill in for a game here or there. But who comes off the bench? Maybe it's a little bit of an ego thing, but it's incredibly important, because if you're out there at the end, if we're talking about, look, LeBron and AD are going to be on that court for sure. Those next three spots, maybe there's a little bit of a matchup thing, but you got to figure that Kuz has got to take one of those spots. And that's far more important than being out there to jump ball the game. It's who's going to knock down the shot that he knocked down last night.
When I was coming off the bench when I was a rookie, DeShaun Gilbert and Jimmy Jones, and I would always watch and see what the guard is doing or whoever's blocking them, how they're setting, right? And I'm looking for my spot. You know, when I'm seeing it, I'm like, okay, well, that's what he's giving me. As soon as I'm in the game, that's exactly what I'm attacking. So, and my D-line coach, the head coach, we're all, and D-coordinator, we're all on the same page when they put me in the game. I could almost predict when I was going in. When we saw the same thing, oh, that guard is really jumping out. Let's put DeMarco in and exploit that A-gap. Same thing with Kyle Kuzma. Oh, man, they're giving him too much space. Or they're not switching when they're supposed to, or they're a little bit late here and there. You can kind of predict when you're going in and what you're asked to do without even being told, just by watching the floor and watching what's going on in front of you. So if you can get that sort of synergy from a guy coming off the bench with the head coach and who's on the floor, and your team can just adjust on the fly and you don't miss a beat, man, you become a perennial playoff contender and a championship contender just like that.
All right. I did not think that as of 8:12 on Tuesday morning that we would still have a college football season, but we do. For how much longer is the question? That's next on the morning show on 710 ESPN. So I'm looking at my TV right now, DeMarco, and I'm looking at Trevor Lawrence. I'm looking at Scott Frost. I know that Nick Saban has weighed in. James Franklin has weighed in. Ryan Day from Ohio State. Jim Harbaugh, of course, from Michigan. They want to play football. And yesterday, it seemed like when we found out that the Power Five commissioners all had a conversation on Sunday about what they were going to do. When we found out yesterday, there was actually a report. Turns out it was inaccurate, but a report yesterday that the Big Ten had pulled the plug on fall sports. They're expected to make a decision today. The Pac-12 is expected to make a decision today. And yesterday, I would have put it at about 99.9% chance that we were not going to have a college football season. I think that number is down. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's far from a sure thing, because the players and coaches are really advocating to try to put this college football season together.
Yeah, I mean, look, coaches are paid to play and win games, and players want to play. We all know this. This is no shock. So, you know, as long as these coaches assume the responsibility, and they do from the time they're sitting in your living room trying to convince your parents to, you know, let me have your child for 3 to 4 years, 5 years, whatever it is, I will take care of them. I will help them grow from a boy to a man. If they can guarantee, or at least reasonably guarantee, I will make sure that we will have everything sanitized. Everywhere they go, everything they do will be monitored. We will keep them as far away from this virus, this pandemic, as humanly possible. And you know Nick Saban is all about that in Alabama, and Scott Frost in Nebraska. They're all about that. I mean, guys want to follow the law all the time. But if you can somehow maintain or keep these guys together in the safest possible environment, how can you possibly say no to that as a parent or as an administrator?
Well, because of history, because of human beings, because we know that good intentions are not nearly enough. That you know, I look, for instance, I want to read this quote from Nick Saban. What he says about wanting to play the season is the following: I want to play, but I want to play for the player's sake, the value they can create for themselves. I know I'll be criticized no matter what I say, that I don't care about player safety. Look, players are a lot safer with us than they are running around at home. We have around a 2% positive ratio on our team since the 4th of July. It's a lot higher than that in society. We act like these guys can't get this unless they play football. They can get it anywhere, whether they're in a bar or just hanging out. DeMarco, in a vacuum, on the surface of what Nick Saban is just saying, I agree 100% that it is probably safer for these guys to be in an environment that's closely monitored, where they're being tested regularly, where conditions are being sanitized, where people are very aware of what's going on, and they're trying their damnedest to make sure that they're mitigating any potential infections. I get that.
this is when human beings come involved, because good intentions are great, but we know that the execution of these plans is very rarely what we're talking about, that ultimately they're going to want to do a little more. Ultimately, people get a little lax in these things, that it just isn't as easy as saying, oh, we'll follow all the rules, because, you know, I don't know about you, I'll follow the rules most of the time, but I know myself at 21 years old. There's stuff out there that I might want to go do. There's stuff, there's people out there I might want to go see. There are other things that are going to draw my attention. And it just is too risky to do this. And I'm not talking about from an infection standpoint. I'm talking about this from an economic standpoint, that if the worst thing happens, then what happens to these athletic departments? What happens to these coaches? What happens to these administrators? That's what they're trying to weigh. Not that, hey, what if our star wide receiver gets sick? We can't have a season. That's not the issue. The issue is, what if that guy ends up on a ventilator? That's what they're trying to figure out.
Oh, no doubt. And, you know, I can remember times, and this is just the environment you're in as a college football player, as a football player, period. I remember being indoors so long, and you would open the doors and be surprised by snow. You know, the whole world had to deal with it. They got their caps and their scarves, and we were so homogenized in our world that, like, wow, I didn't even know what was going on outside. You know, I had no idea. Or just being, like, being at the Super Bowl in Atlanta, and it was a melee outside. It was an ice storm that I didn't know about because I was in the hotel. Or the Ray Lewis situation. I had no idea what had happened, because we were on our schedule and we were in our team meetings, and it was just not a part of our world. So I get it. So, and every team, every college, every football team, period, has rules. And if you sneak out, break curfew, okay, that means we're going to have to run laps because you broke the rules. We're going to have to pay for what you did. Now, it's the same, but just it's ratcheted up a lot. Okay, if you break the rules, we're not going to run. Somebody here could get sick. And then somebody could make somebody else sick, and they could wind up in the hospital and possibly not make it. So it just really reinforces those team rules that Nick Saban and Scott Frost and Jim Harbaugh and every other coach, you know, puts in place for his team. We have to follow the rules. Everybody's the same. But now it's just a little bit different because we have to keep everyone safe at the same time. So I don't think there's anybody better suited to do that than a college football coach. He runs your life anyway.
Yeah, but they run their lives for a single, that's to win football games. It's not to keep them safe. And I get that some guys can do it both ways, but these guys are singularly focused. They want to win football games. If that means a little extra time in a meeting room, if that means a little extra time on the practice field, a little extra time here and there, I just think that they're going to push the envelope and ultimately at the expense of safety. And here's the other part too. That's just, you're looking at this saying, wait, hold on a second. The vast majority, not all, but the vast majority of these universities are telling their students, hey, stay home, do your classes online, right? We want to be as safe as we can. Stay home, do school online, which makes perfect sense. But you're going to ask the football players to come to campus and put themselves in a potentially risky situation? And because we know why we're doing it. We know that there's a $78 million chunk of change hanging out there if there's no football season that they're not going to get. So there's big money involved. Players don't get any of it. I mean, true. We can go around and around about this idea of, well, yes, they do get things. Yeah, they get a scholarship, which is valuable, you know, perhaps now more than ever before, seeing how expensive college is. But it's a $78 million windfall for the university, and I get none of it. And and I'm potentially going to get sick, and I'm potentially going to get worse than that. And look, I get why the NFL is going to play. I get it. They're all men. They're all adults. They all make a lot of money. Even the guys that by NFL standards don't make a lot of money, they make a lot of money. You make 500 grand in the real world. That's a ton of money, right? So they're going to go do it. They're going to go. They're making a decision. This is what this is the risk. This is the reward. I'm going to take the reward. What's the reward for these guys?
Well, I mean, look, you get your degree and sometimes you get to move on and you're a better person. I mean, it's the same stuff we've been talking about with that the NCAA tries to push. And we all know that, you know, a lot of that needs to be changed. And part of that is just not true. The myth of the student athlete is just that. It's a myth. We need to call it what it is. So I think through this whole process and how much of a disaster it's been to this point, I think we'll give –
more credibility to players wanting to unionize. Most people were so against it. They hated it. They couldn't stand it. But I think now I think we need to give the players a voice, and I think they're exercising that voice. And going back to your point about, you know, keeping the kids in school or sending them home or what have you, I would rather have kids in Tuscaloosa where Nick Saban can, you know, be at the front door, literally, of the dorm to where you can't get in and out without going past him versus sending them back to Florida. You know what I mean? Like, go ahead. Mm-hmm. We'll see you in a couple of months when this thing's over. Good luck. I'd rather have them there than go home. I don't know what that makes me, but I think having them there with a Nick Saban type or your head coach, your administrator, your guy, I think is much safer than saying, okay, good luck out there in the free world with everyone else, where the people aren't following the rules.
I totally agree with you if it were that easy, that this idea that are they safer in a dorm room that's being sanitized and monitored or just going home and living their life? No question about it. Being in the dorm is probably safer. I 100% get that. My argument isn't which one is better. My argument is why are they there at all? This is the thing, that this is we need to win, we need to make money, we need to do this, and we can't do it without these guys. Because if this were the way that college athletics were ultimately set up, you know, 150 years ago, that, hey, we'd like to stay fit. You know, between English and philosophy, I'd like to get a nice sweat on. I think I'm going to go play for the football team. That's not what this is.
No, right.
This is about money. This is a professional sport in every single meaningful way. And when they go in there, I think that the good intentions will get less and less and less, and the impetus to go win at all costs will get louder and louder, because that's the job. That's what we created.
No doubt.
And
Sean McVay
is what it is.
Sean McVay right here, if you told him he had to wear magnetic boots and you had to walk on the ceiling and coach upside down, he'd go, okay, I don't like it, but look, this is the way we have to do it. Jared, you have to be more accurate with your passing. You know what I mean? If you have to spread out and coach everyone, he's going to say, okay, that's the rules. That's what we need to do. Okay, this is how we're going to get better, because everyone has to do it. So that's why we give these guys these big salaries. They are driven, and they're supposed to teach young men that, look, the world's not going to wait. If there's an issue outside, you still have to drive through, push through. You have to – I hate to say – well, I don't even want to say it, but you have to have the courage to keep going. You just can't curl up into a ball and hope it passes over. Sometimes you got to go out into the world that's tough and try to make a living. So, you know, at some point – down the road, whatever you're being taught there is going to show up when you're 40, 45, 50 years old, and you're going to have to lead your family, not just be a football player.
All right, DeMarco, let's take a look at the pro game. Let's take a look at that NFC West, which I think we all agree is the toughest division in football. What exactly are the Rams going up against this year? That's next on the Morning Show on 710 ESPN. So 9-7 a year ago, they were the first team to miss the playoffs, right? So under the new format, the Rams would have made the playoffs last year at 9-7. Under last year's format, they just missed. We talked about it yesterday, DeMarco. Greg Zuerlein misses a kick in Seattle by about a football that he usually makes. We have a blown coverage by a rookie in Taylor Rapp late in the game against San Francisco that ultimately turns that game in one direction. That's a loss that if you get that one, you go into the playoffs. So there's a couple of decisive moments along the way. Rams are going to be a different team. Todd Gurley is gone. Brandon Cooks is gone. Corey Littleton is gone. Dante Fowler is gone. All three coordinators are gone. You got brand new guys coming in. And, oh, by the way, another team in your division is the defending conference champion in San Francisco. We know what those dudes up in Seattle are. They're good every single year. And then you look down the road in Phoenix with Kyler Murray, who had, I thought, a pretty good rookie season. You give him arguably the best wide receiver in football and DeAndre Hopkins, another year in Cliff Kingsbury's system. And all of a sudden, you're in a division where those six games you got to play against those guys, all six of those are dogfights.
Yeah, they're tough because they're so multiple. I just remember being in Arizona, and I'm on the sideline with the guys, and I lost sight of Kyler Murray. This is when he was carrying the football or scrambling, and he just gets lost, and all of a sudden he just clears himself, and either he runs with it or he finds a way to get the ball out. That reminds me of Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson is just the greatest scrambling quarterback this side of Fran Tarkenton. Whatever the play, he can extend it by 5-6 seconds, and just absolutely kill you to death. So it's tough playing everyone. And San Francisco will just beat you up. I mean, the offensive line, the defensive line, and the way they run their football team is just absolutely physical. It's like old school black and blue ball. If you lose to them, you'll lose for the next 2 weeks because you're just physically beat up from them. That's how they do it. So the one thing about them is how long can they keep that up? I'm not sure, but we'll see. But this division is so tough because it's so multiple and the quarterbacks that you have to face week in and week out. So, but the one thing about the Rams season, and you look at their tough beats, a missed field goal. That's one where you say, if we hit the field goal, we win and things change there. If you don't have the blown coverage, that's a mistake. That's something we can correct. So Bobby Knight says it best. You learn more from your losses. So the core group, the Jared Goffs, the Aaron Donalds, the leadership on this team, they can learn. We will never let these X, Y, and Z, the way we lost last season, we will never let these happen again. So if you get those wins, you're talking about 10, 11, 12 wins, and you're right back in the thick of things. So that season can help propel you for this year to get back to where you need to be.
Let's start with Arizona for a second because, you know, it's in the Sean McVay era, that's the one team, and the Rams have had a lot of success against a lot of different teams, but the Arizona Cardinals are the one team that they've just beat like a mule, right? They just have absolutely crushed them every single time that they've played them, going back to when Sean McVay first got there. Is that over? Has Kyler Murray changed that? DeAndre Hopkins, I would imagine, has certainly changed that. And I still, for the life of me, don't understand how DeAndre Hopkins, coming off of the season that he had, coming off the career that he had in Houston, they just decided to go in a different direction. That they got him for virtually nothing makes no sense to me. And that, you know, a bad decision by the Texans becomes the Rams' problem because they got a quarterback that's, like you said, very dangerous because of what he can do with his legs. But now, I know Larry Fitzgerald's a Hall of Famer, but he's not that threat that he used to be. DeAndre Hopkins sure as hell is.
Oh, yeah. Championship teams are built by what the Texans are doing. When you're driven by emotion and one guy, and I'm just so frustrated with X, Y, and Z, I'll just dump all my best players. Well, you can build championship teams from that squad, and that's what you're seeing. So the Cardinals get, you know, arguably the one of the best receivers in the league. I mean, as dangerous as Antonio Brown was. I mean, Antonio Brown could run any route at any second and adjust on the fly. Well, Hopkins is the same way, but he's a little bit more dangerous because of what happens after the catch. He will literally fight you off to get to open field and keep going. So you add that to Kyler Murray, and you've got problems. With Kyler Murray, it's the same thing you said about May here, the pitcher for the Dodgers. Eventually, this guy's going to be one of the best pitchers in the league. You can see that with Kyler Murray. Once this guy gets more experience and he gets a few more toys to play with, some better weapons around him, he's going to be dangerous. He's dangerous now without an offensive line. Imagine if he actually gets some protection and some more competent receiving out there and a better game plan. You're in trouble. So, yeah, the more he goes, the better he's going to get. And then even Russell Wilson is going to have to take notice of what's happening down there in Arizona. So they are building. And Seattle is built, and Pete Carroll is just – he's a wellspring of endless enthusiasm. So he always thinks he's in the hunt, and he knows how to prepare, in my opinion, better than just about anybody else in this division for a championship run. So – they're always going to be, you know, right there for you. But Kyler Murray in Arizona with DeAndre Hopkins and Larry Fitzgerald, a guy you still haven't figured out how to cover because he's so big. He's a tight end playing receiver. He can block. Mm-hmm. He can do it all. And you add that with Hopkins, man, I mean, they are a snootful. If they fix it on defense, you've got issues down there in Arizona. That's going to change in a hurry.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Seattle there too. And there's been so much attention, rightfully so, talked about Bill Belichick and Tom Brady and how, you know, which of those two guys makes that go? That in the 20 years together, they go to 9 Super Bowls, they win 6 of them. Is it because Tom Brady's the dude? Is it because Bill Belichick's the dude? And the answer is, it's because they're both the dudes. It's the ultimate combination. It feels a lot like that in Seattle, too, that Russell Wilson is a special, special player. He's you and I think have talked about this for the last 3 or 4 years. He's the one guy in the league that every time he takes a snap, I'm like, oh man, oh, here we go. Oh no. Every single time, because like you said, he's running around and like Aaron Donald's about to rip his head off, and then he escapes, and then he hits somebody down the field and they keep it moving. Pete Carroll is a really good NFL coach. He's just you're not good every single season if you don't have a coach that knows how to. And they've done it a couple of different ways. They've done it with a defense. They've done it with guys called Legion of Boom. Most of those guys are gone now. They've retooled that defense on the fly. Though, as long as those two guys are there, Carroll and Russell Wilson, the Seahawks, I know coming in, they haven't won the division in a couple of years because the Rams won it twice in a row. San Francisco won it. But you look at this and you say, Seattle is the team to beat coming in every single year because of those two dudes.
No doubt. And speaking of Aaron Donald versus Seattle, if you replace Russell Wilson with Charlie Whitehurst,
he would be dead.
I don't know how else to say it. He would be absolutely dead. I mean, Aaron wins a lot. Especially versus Seattle. He brings his A game for everyone, but especially Seattle. If not for Russell Wilson, Aaron Donald's sack numbers would be way up, more than they are now, because Russell can just escape. But here's something else. I know we give Robert Woods a lot of credit for being the most underrated receiver in the league, and a lot of that's true, but DK Metcalf up in Seattle is an issue. He's an absolute issue. And the other guy that no one talks about until you play him is Lockett, Tyler Lockett.
Yeah.
He always seems to be open down the field, right? So I like the way they're built. They're built to run the football, but they're also built to emphasize what Russell Wilson can do in the pocket, scrambling and throwing the football. So they have a pretty good idea on offense and defense. Like you said, it's going to be a little bit different. If you don't have the crowd noise in Seattle, they're going to come back to earth, but that noise versus how Pete Carroll wants to win football games and coach defensively, they always seem to have the right pieces that can just get after anybody's run game and their quarterback. So they're always dangerous. So the offense is run through Wilson and his dynamic presence, and Pete Carroll kind of controls what's going on defense. So I agree with you. It is kind of like Belichick, but with a personality.
Yeah, they approach it a little bit differently, but the results are fairly similar. Same Who way. Is that guy for you, DeMarco, as far as just every time you saw that guy on the field, when you were playing, that when he'd get that ball and he'd snap that ball, you're like, I think I got this guy, but I know I'm going to get there and he's going to be gone. Who is that guy for you?
Well, the magician type, like, oh my God, there's nothing I can do. And this is just, absolutely maddening. Like it's playing a chess game against a grandmaster and you've got absolutely no chance. Steve Young. I mean, it was a BYU type butt kicking. It was mental as well as physical. I mean, he's changing tempo. I mean, he's always got the right decision for the right defense. And it just seems like nothing you can do to beat the guy. And he would absolutely keep the hammer down. You know, there are some guys, you know, you watch boxing, right? Manny Pacquiao. Manny Pacquiao has a heart. If he's beating this guy to death, he'll back off and try to hug the guy. I don't want to hurt you. If Steve Young had you, I mean, he's going to put 56, and that's only because he couldn't put 63 on you. You know what I mean? he's an absolute hammer. So the other guy, and there's one other guy that I never really got to face, and I didn't want to face him, was Barry Sanders. I saw what he did to other people and how he made some good defenders look stupid. I want no part of him. Absolutely. You know, really, there's nothing you can do scheme-wise to stop him.
Yeah, they're just some guys. Look, Sanders and Young and Wilson, these guys also have incredible athletic gifts, to be sure. But it's also just that just when you think you're about to get them, they're gone. Just when you think I finally have Russell Wilson, and here comes Aaron Donald. And then Aaron Donald gets there. I guarantee you Russell Wilson is remembered all the times he has gotten him and not all the times that I remember where he gets away. But it just is so frustrating to deal with. Like, when Jimmy Garoppolo drops back and I see Aaron Donald coming, I'm like, he might kill him. And I don't worry about it. But with Russell Wilson, until I see that man in the ground, it's just a totally different
this
dynamic.
I told Aaron this. If you ever get a roughing the passer on Russell Wilson, I would not be mad because he's earned it. Not you. He's earned it by getting away from you.
Be chill, Russ. Unless you want some real pain, I'm going to need you to let me get me a couple of times long way. Dodgers can't hit right now. How big of a problem is it? That's coming up next on the morning show on 710 ESPN. You know things are going good, DeMarco, when you have an 11-6 record and you can't hit. Because that's where the Dodgers are right now. They lost a game last night to the Padres. Close game, 2-1. They only got four hits last night, and a bunch of the guys that you would expect to be doing a bunch of work are not. Jock Peterson is under 200. Cody Bellinger looks awful. I mean, I'm a Cody Bellinger fan, and I'm not super worried about what he's going to look like at some point, but he does not look right now. Justin Turner only has one home run this season. Max Muncy's batting .182. They just can't seem to get anything going, and under normal circumstances, what have they played? They've played 17 games. You'd see what difference does it make? They're winning, but this isn't normal circumstances. I mean, they've already played more than 25% of their season, and a couple of their very important players can't get going. It's an odd mix of it's not a big deal and it's a huge deal.
You know, when do you start to panic? Like, how long do you give streaks before you actually call them a streak in baseball? Like, this is a slump versus this is just a bad, you know, day, a bad week, a bad month?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm going to try to answer it without giving you a number. For me, it's how are they swinging the bat? Like, for instance, Mookie Betts got off to a little bit of a slow start, but watching him swing the bat, it never looked like he was uncomfortable. It never looked like he was doing anything other than not getting hits. The swing was good. His pitch selection was good. He was aggressive in the batter's box, but not so aggressive that he was chasing bad pitches. And Mookie's kind of found his groove. He's performing about how you would expect him to be. He'll probably get a little better because he's better than a 279 guy, but Mookie looks good. Cody Bellinger doesn't look good. He's taking bad swings. His pitch identification doesn't seem to be as sharp as it typically is. That to me, that's the tell when guys are swinging at bad pitches or they're taking good pitches. And last night, a couple of times, he took some pitches that were just, you know, center cut meatballs and watched him go by and then kind of flailed at some bad pitches. That to me is a much bigger tell than, you know, it's been 8 games or 20 games. It's how are you swinging the bat? Right now, Cody Bellinger swinging the bat really poorly.
Maybe there's a confidence issue there. It was something you said yesterday about Clayton Kershaw, and just it's not what's happening in the home runs, and that's fun. You can look that up in the stat column. But something that doesn't show up is you said it was the sound that it made. When guys are getting hit, like it's a solid crack,
it's loud
type,
it's
yeah, loud. Loud hit. So, I mean, I think that's what I judge, like you said, baseball wise. If a guy's just not hitting and his average is down, his OPS is down, but when I'm watching or I'm hearing and he's hitting the ball hard, eventually those are going to drop. Those line drives are going to drop. Eventually he's going to start hitting. So, you know, right now, maybe it's just taking him a minute, Bellinger. Maybe it's just taking him a little bit more time to adjust to what's going on. I think that's actually valid. You know, if you're a guy that depends on the juice of what's around you, the environment, to get going, mm-hmm. to mentally lock in, this is going to affect you, and you're going to have to find other ways to do it. So maybe that's the case. Or maybe this is his year to have a slump. But as of right now, like you said, he just does not look good at the plate.
This would be absolutely insane to suggest under any situation other than the one we have right now. And that is the idea of, you know what, maybe you got to give him a few days to not play. Because Cody Bellinger is the reigning MVP of the league, right? That if he had a bad 17-game stretch, you're not thinking about taking him out of the lineup, because why would you? He's too important. This isn't a normal situation. And the Dodgers are flush with other options. Right. And we saw it when they benched him for a game in Arizona. He came back the next day and hit a home run and looked a little better. But and you thought, OK, you know, I don't know if it's a wake up call or just a kind of a breath of fresh air. Just OK, I'm going to take a day off and just kind of check out, not have to worry about it and just hit the reset button. That's what it was. But it didn't really work. He's still not looking real sharp. I don't know if you try another day off. I don't know if you try a couple of days off, because they have other guys you can put in the lineup. They don't have a guy as good as him. He's a better player on a, you know, if you're just kind of checking boxes, but he's just going so bad right now. This is the decision that not just Dave Roberts, but really every manager in Major League Baseball has to make right now, which is, when do I decide I have to make a change? Because I asked Dave Roberts this a month or so ago. I say, will you have a quicker hook when it comes to making lineup decisions? He goes, yeah, you have to. I just, there's just not enough time to let a guy figure it out. We talked to Pedro a minute ago. He said 50 at-bats isn't nothing, and he doesn't look right. So maybe you do give him a couple of days to try to figure it out in the cage.
Well, isn't this the dual edge of being that guy, is you don't get days off. you know, I did a podcast with Isaac Bruce, and he was talking about the time where he had strained his hamstring right before we're getting ready to play Minnesota in the playoffs, and he didn't tell anybody. He ran from people, the head coach, the trainer. He didn't want to tell anybody because, you know, he didn't want that sort of thing to get into his mental. But you have to go out. You don't get the opportunity to have days off and to get your head right. You're going to have to get your head right while playing because you are the guy. That's why you're getting paid, and that's what being MVP means. You're going to have to play your way through it. So sometimes, in my opinion, it could be right or wrong. It's not days off that they need. It's you need to stay out there until you figure it out. You know, if you're not swinging the club well and everything's a shank, you can't throw it down and say, forget it, I'll come back tomorrow. No, keep hitting. I'll sit here with you. We're going to play can't see to can't see until you figure this damn thing out. It sucks. You're going to hate it. You're going to cuss people out. But sometimes that's exactly what you need to get back on track.
That's the downside to where the Dodgers are right now. That guys like Bellinger, Peterson's struggling a little bit. Max Muncy is in a bad way too. He's not identifying balls nearly as well as I've seen him do in the past either. But here's the upside: it hasn't mattered. I mean, they're winning anyway, and they're winning because dudes like Dustin May, he's real close to being the very last guy you want to have to go face, and. Put it to you this way. Clayton Kershaw was that guy 5 years ago where you knew, oh, man, I got Kershaw on two nights. All right, well, there's an 0-for-4, and he might screw me up so bad that I don't get hit for two nights after that. That Clayton Kershaw is not that guy anymore. Dustin May might be because he just has the most electric stuff that we've seen in a really long time. And last night he was good, not great. He walked a couple of guys in one inning and it cost him. It ended up costing him a run. Hosmer squirts a little soft single to left field and it ends up being the winning run. But you could tell that was just one of those things that he's going to learn. You don't throw an off-speed pitch to a bad guy like Austin Hedges. Austin Hedges does not have Dustin May bat speed. He threw him an off-speed pitch, guy squares it up, hits a home run, there's the other run. That lap around the track that he took last night, he learned something. He won't do that again. And so every time he makes one of those mistakes, he's going to be better the next time. And I just get the sense he's a really quick study with that stuff. Once he gets it between the ears and it feels like he's really close, forget it.
I hope he doesn't go nuke LaLouche. You know, he ain't seen my fastball. You know, I'll get him again the next time. But let's move into the champagne problem for a hot minute. And just from a pure, I guess, what's more appealing to you? And I've had this debate about, you know, God rest his soul, Kobe Bryant versus LeBron James. Who's greater? I don't know. That's for other people to decide. But I'd rather watch Kobe play than LeBron because I think his game is prettier. So Clayton Kershaw versus May, as long as they're effective, that's all I care about. But whose stuff do you think is prettier? Or whose stuff do you like more, like to watch more?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'll take. If we're talking about at their best, like the best version of Kershaw versus the best version of May, give me Kershaw, because Kershaw had that big overhand curveball that would just wreck guys. And plus, I don't care what it's like. It's a guy swinging a bat. It's a guy swinging a golf club. It's a guy throwing a baseball. Anything that is left-handed just looks better, right?
Okay,
it's
fair
just,
enough.
You just watch a guy swing a bat from the left-hand side. It looks better. You watch that big curveball with Clayton Kershaw from the left side. It looks better. I'll take that, but I'll tell you what. Give me five more years of watching Dustin May throw 99 mile an hour fastballs that slide 2 feet just because they do, and I might change my answer.
I like guys leaving, you know, the batter's box with the bat still on their shoulder going, I don't want any part of that, versus swinging a miss and you twisted it, you know, God knows what. Yeah, I just like the power stuff. It just to me, that is baseball, watching that.
Well, when you – was it not last night, the time before when May pitched against Machado, when he struck him out on that cutter that ran in on him like that sinker, Machado kind of turned around like, what the hell do you want me to do with that? You know, nothing. I mean, are you kidding me? And that's not some guy. That's Manny Machado, for God's sakes. He's one of the best players in the league, and he's looking out there like, yeah, I got nothing for you on that. See, good job. We'll see you next time.
I call that pulling a John Kruk. I'm out.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. The Lakers get a big one last night. Kyle Kuzma knocks down a jumper. What does that mean for him in the starting lineup moving forward? That's next on the Morning Show on 710 ESPN.